of Esther and Mordecai and Ahasuerus. And again, as we go through this story, chapter 1 was all about Ahasuerus and his wife Vashti. And of course, as we saw, the hand of God is in this story, as God is arranging events to prepare for a need that no one knows is even a need yet. We're gonna see more about that in chapter 3 here this morning. But the Jews are going to need protection. God knows that ahead of time in this story. And so before they even know it, and before the pieces even start to fall into place, God is arranging the circumstances for the protection of His people. Now, God does that for the nation of Israel, and it's not just a past tense thing. It's a present tense and future tense thing. And we as believers and our nation as a country needs to remember this, that God's hand is still with the Jew. And as long as we support them, now this is Bible, this isn't politics. As long as we support them, God will protect us. But the minute we turn our back on them, we turn our back on God's protection, because that's where His protection is. So when we talk about our president or political leaders and decisions they make affecting the whole country, yes, decisions concerning abortion and homosexuality and all have moral weight on our country, but probably the greatest decision or the most weighty decision that our politicians have to make is how do we handle the situation with Israel. And for you and I as Bible believers, there's no question we support them. And so God in the book of Esther is planning all of the events to protect His people from this fellow we read about in chapter 3. Chapter 1 was about Ahasuerus and Vashti. Chapter 2 is about Esther, her elevation into the palace in Shushan. And there's a reason God put her there. And she gets there before Haman shows up in his position that he's going to be promoted to. Notice Esther chapter 3 and verse 1. After these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman. Now he's going to be one of the main characters throughout the rest of the book of Esther. He promotes Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. Now we'll come back to this in a little bit and find out, if I can use a word I used in a sermon title, why the animosity. We'll find out why Haman is so anti-Jew, anti-Semitic. There's a reason for it. And when people are anti-Semitic, there's a reason for it. And it's not usually the reason you think it is. And we'll find out in a minute why Haman is that way. Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him, the king did, advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman. All right, the king Ahasuerus has elevated Haman and made him the man. All right, he's his right hand. He's the vice president, whatever you want to call him. Haman now is that guy. And he gets the respect from all the king's servants in verse 2, all the king's servants that were in the king's gate. Go back to chapter 2, if you would, in verse 21, just as a reminder. The end of chapter 2 ended this way. In those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door, were wroth and sought to lay hand on the king Ahasuerus, and the thing was known to Mordecai. Mordecai is in the king's gate. He's around the servants of the palace. What his position is, we're not told. But he's in the inner circle, so to speak, there when it comes to the servants of the king in the king's gate. Not everyone is allowed there. But Mordecai has whatever relationship or position that he's allowed at the back door of the servants' entrance, so to speak. And he's privy, or he's involved in all the information that's going on among the servants in the palace. That's why he overheard this plot in chapter 2 and verse 21 of two of the servants that were going to try to kill the king. He overheard that because he's there in the king's gate among the servants. So verse 2 says, all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. All right, get the picture in your mind. As Haman comes to the White House every day, just to put it in our understanding, as he comes to the palace every day, all the other servants there that are around the early morning entrance to the palace, all those that are there at the wee hours of the morning when Haman shows up, they bow down and give reverence to Haman, but Mordecai doesn't. He just stands erect. He just stands straight back. He won't bow to him. Now, of course, you and I know why they do that, because the Jewish law commands them that they're to bow to no man. I just read through first chapters of Daniel last night where Daniel interpreted the dream for Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar bowed down to him. And here's Daniel, a young boy, probably about 16 at that time, and he's allowing this great king Nebuchadnezzar to bow down to him when he interprets a dream for him. And as soon as you hear, "And Nebuchadnezzar commanded all men to bow down to Daniel," you're thinking, lion's den. God's going to put him in the lion. He's going to tell him, hey, you're not supposed to have anybody bowing down to you. And so here is Mordecai, and he refuses to bow down to any man because he knows the Jewish law forbids that. You're only to bow down before God. And so Mordecai will not bow. Notice verse 3. And I like the Bible because I like that it tells a 2,000-year-old story, and yet it could be today. Mordecai has made a decision. He's put his feet on solid ground. I'm not going to compromise on what I know is right. I'm not going to bow down to anybody. All the others might do it. I'm not going to do it. Like the three boys in Daniel's book again. But notice verse 3. Then the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said to Mordecai, "Why transgressest thou the king's commandment?" The pressure doesn't start from Haman himself. It starts from the other servants at the king's gate. They look at him and say, "Hey, we're all bowing down. Why aren't you? Why can't you be like us? Why can't you just fit in? Just for once in your life. Don't make a big deal about something. Don't think your law is higher than our law. Just bow down." That's the pressure that's usually put on a Christian in our day. Come on, one drink isn't going to hurt. Just come out with the guys. Just be one of us just for a little while. Quit being so high and mighty. Quit being so holy and noble. Just let your hair down. Have some fun. The same pressure that's recorded in the Bible 2,000 years ago. There's nothing new under the sun. And so they say, "Why transgressest thou the king's commandment?" Verse 4. You think they're going to stop there? Well, if you've dealt with this world, you know they're not going to stop there. The pressure isn't going to back off. Verse 4. Now it came to pass when they spake daily unto him. All right, they're pressuring Mordecai every day. Come on, Mordecai, today just bow down to him. It'll really puzzle him. He'll wonder what in the world's going on. Just make a joke out of it. Just bow down to him. See how stunned he'll be. They speak to him daily, and he hearkened not unto them. Good for him. Too many Christians do hearken. Too many Christians do back down when the pressure becomes hot. They hearken not to them, that they told Haman. All right, now these are friends of Mordecai's, the servants in the gate. Mordecai won't bow down. They every day, "Come on, just bow down. Yeah, just this one time. We'll know you don't really mean it. We'll know you're just doing it to fit in, but we understand." He wouldn't do it. So they go tell Haman what's going on. They told Haman to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand. You know what they're doing? They're putting him to the test. We're going to see if your walk is as big as your talk. And they went and told Haman. They maybe Haman didn't notice it up to this point. And they wanted Mordecai on the spot. They wanted him to have to make this decision, whether he's going to stand or whether he's going to bow. And they go to Haman and they tell him, the end of verse 4, "For he had told them that he was a Jew." Now verse 5 says, "And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not," you know what that tells me? He didn't notice it before then. Now he notices it because they've come and said, "Hey, there's one of these guys that won't bow down to you, and he's a Jew." Now Haman, the next time he comes in, he pays special attention to that one guy to see if he's going to bow or not. "And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath." All right, now ego's going to come into the play. Here's a guy that walks in every day, and everybody bows down but one, and he's going to focus on that one. You know, in the workplace, if you're that one, everybody's going to know who that one is. If You're trying to do right and live right and talk right and act right, everybody's going to know who that one is. And it's not always because they're impressed. It's because they want to see if it's really going to stand. And they're going to do things to put you to the test. They're going to find different ways to test your faith and your Christianity to see whether it will stand or not. And I know I'm preaching to the choir. I'm talking to people that already know that to be true. You work out in this world and around lost people for any amount of time, they mark you. Once they know that you're a Christian, you get marked. That's why so many Christians don't want to have their testimony show. They don't want to be marked. Not even for Jesus Christ. And that's a shame. But you stand up for Christ, you're going to get marked. Some people will naturally respect that, but many are going to find it an item to ridicule. Something to go after. Some people, and it's usually the more, can I say it? I'm looking back through the annals of time in personal history. It's usually the more wicked that really want to make an issue out of your faith. And here's the thing. They want you to do wrong. They want to blow that testimony and that, as they look at it, holier-than-thou attitude. But can I tell you this? At the same time, if you do blow it, they're going to be the ones that are most disappointed. And they don't even know that. They will tempt you and try to get you to do that. And then once you compromise and yield to something you know is wrong, just to appease them and not stick out like a sore thumb, they actually, when it's all over, they didn't know this was coming, but they're going to be disappointed. Because they literally had put Mordecai on a high shelf because he wouldn't bow down. And the minute he bows, they're going to be disappointed because they thought they had met somebody of different character and of different stock that they really respected, though it didn't come out that way. And here, Haman sees Mordecai not bowing or doing reverence. And it's an old southern expression, it's a grit in his craw. That's all he can focus on. Every day when he comes in, he doesn't see all the other people that are bowing. He sees the one that's not bowing. And that thing just sticks to him, and he can't get over it. That one man won't bow down to me. And it's going to consume him. We get on through the store, and he goes home and starts telling his family about it. I mean, he can't get away from that. He goes and tells all the relatives, it's a wonderful life. I go in there and I'm in the king's palace, I'm his right-hand man, and everybody bows down except this way. He even tells his whole family about that, and they make a plan of how to get rid of him. I don't want to steal, most of you have read it anyways, but we don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but it just bothers him. He's full of wrath, the end of verse 5. Verse 6, and he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had showed him the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. All right, now this thing's getting bigger. His hatred is toward Mordecai. He won't bow. But then they tell him, hey, by the way, did you know Mordecai is a Jew? And Haman expands his desire and plan to destroy Mordecai to encompass destroying all the people of Mordecai. That sounds a little drastic, even for an excitable heathen. To have one guy that won't bow and say, I'm going to destroy the whole race. Well, that sounds like Hitler. I'm going to wipe out all of them because that one man won't bow down and he's a Jew. Why the intense hatred? I'm glad you asked. Turn back to 1 Samuel chapter 15. There's nothing like the Bible to give you the answer when you have a question. Why is Haman, though we can understand he's mad at Mordecai, Mordecai won't bow, but he starts out with his anger toward Mordecai and wrath towards him. Now he expands it to all the Jewish. Let's wipe out all of them. In all 127 provinces that Ahasuerus rules and reigns over, let's wipe them all out. Why? Why the intense hatred? Somebody say, well, because he knows if that man's a Jew and he won't bow, then probably all the Jews won't bow, and so he wants to get rid of all of them because they all won't bow. Well, that's speculation. Let's go with fact. Remember what it said in Esther chapter 3, verse 1? Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. All right, all these different Hittites and Hivites and Canaanites and all those, they all were named that because of the name of the founder of that racial ethnic group. All right? The Canaanites were called Canaanites because Canaan was the father of that race. The Hittites, because of height. All right? All the different ones that were named after one. The Amalekites from Amalek. All right? The Agagites are the descendants of a fella named Agag. We read about him in 1 Samuel chapter 15. Notice this to refresh your mind of the story. In verse 2, the Lord of hosts said, I remember now which Amalek did to Israel, how he laid wait for him in the way when he came to Egypt. Now go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass. All right, God tells Samuel, God tells Saul, go wipe out the Amalekites. All right, the king of the Amalekites at this time is a fellow named Agag. Notice down in verse number 8. And Saul took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive. Now God had said destroy them all, but he took one alive. And utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag. He wasn't supposed to. Saul was supposed to kill him in the battle, but he took the king as a prisoner, so to speak. Now look, if you would, all the way down. Oops, I'm back to Esther. Back down to verse number 32 of 1 Samuel 15. All right, he'd spared Agag, and Samuel the prophet says, bring ye hither to me Agag, the king of the Amalekites. And Agag came unto him delicately. I like that word. Agag was supposed to be slain in battle. He was taken as a POW. He was taken as a prisoner. But God had told Samuel, wipe them all out. Saul had spared him, so Samuel says, bring Agag. And Agag said, at the end of verse 32, surely the bitterness of death is past. Verse 33, and Samuel said, as thy sword hath made women childless, so shall thy mother be childless among women. And Samuel hewed Agag in pieces before the Lord in Gilgal. Agag, when he went into battle, wiped out the civilian population. All right, he's made women childless. He's wiped out women and children. He's wiped out the innocents. That is, if you notice, with the terrorism and the Muslims and all that, that's the way they do it. The women and children first. Kill them to demoralize the enemy. Whereas in our American way of fighting, you protect women and children. Just a whole different mentality and upbringing. But Agag had gone after the civilian, innocent civilian population, and God had told Samuel, get rid of him. He's no good. And so Samuel killed him. Samuel, the prophet of the nation of Israel, killed Agag. Here is Haman, a descendant of Agag. He's got a man that won't bow down to him. He's mad at that one man. Then he finds out that man just happens to be Jewish. Descendants of Samuel's race. And so now it turns into a vendetta. Now it's a revenge thing. We're going to get rid of all of them. That's the reason for his hatred. That's the reason for his wrath. He could be mad at Mordecai for not bowing, if that's an important enough thing to be mad about. But now he's extended it to he's going to wipe out the whole race of the Jewish line. Now, you and I can read that and say, boy, does he not know what's coming. Because we know what's going to happen when he lifts up his hand against God's people, the nation of Israel. All right? Verse 6. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. Verse 7. In the first month, that is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of the king Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is the lot, before Haman from day to day and from month to month, to the 12th month, that is the month Adar. That verse in its context seems to indicate that for 12 months they sought their Ouija board. They sought through their mystical signs to find out the right time to go before the king to destroy the people of Mordecai. And from the first month, month Nisan, until the 12th month, the month Adar, they followed their rituals waiting to have a sign of when the right time was. And verse 8, "And Haman said unto King Ahasuerus, There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all provinces of thy kingdom, and their laws are diverse from all people." True. "Neither keep they the king's laws." Well, the one about bowing down. True. "Therefore, it is not for the king's profit to suffer them." False. "It is not for the king's profit to suffer." Yes, it is. "If it so please the king," verse 9, "let it be written that they may be destroyed." Notice the strength of the language. "That they may be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business to bring it to the king's treasury." Haman's saying, "I will personally put the money in the king's bank to pay the men that go out and destroy these people." So it's his desire to destroy him. He's even going to bankroll it. He says, "I'll give the money to the king's tributary to be given to the men that are going to go out and destroy these men." "And the king took his ring from his hand," verse 10, "and gave it unto Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the Jew's enemy." If there's any title you don't want pinned on you, is the Jew's enemy. Iran, Syria, Jordan, these different countries have a tattoo on their forehead right now, and it's the Jew's enemy. You read the book of Revelation, they're going to pay for it. And it's going to be a harsh payment. The Jew's enemy, verse 11. We think about, you know, whenever, I know I'm getting off the subject. When they talk about the Palestinians, you know, there's no thing in the Bible as such thing as a Palestinian. There's no Palestinians in the Bible. This is a social agenda from the anti-Jews to find a people and a homeland for them, to give them the supposed right to kick Israel out of the land, to give this to the Palestine. It's not Palestine. It's the Jews' land. And again, getting off the subject here. The Jews' enemy. "And the king said unto Haman, The silver is given to thee, the people also, to do with them as seemeth good to thee. Then were the king's scribes called on the 13th day of the first month." All right, in verse number 7, it went from January to December, let's put it in our understanding, that they played the Ouija board and cast lots and rolled the dice and all these other things to find out the will of the forces as far as getting rid of the Jewish people. And then he goes in before the king, and as you know, old Jewish customs, the king has a ring, and it's got a seal or an imprint on it. They draw up a document for all these people to be destroyed, and the king gives Haman his ring, and he seals it with the king's ring, and they're going to send it out. And it says that the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and there was written according to all that Haman had commanded unto the king's lieutenants and to the governors that were over every province, and to the rulers of every people of every province according to the writing thereof, to every people after their language. Notice that. 127 provinces, remember, that Ahasuerus rules over. It's not all one language group. And so they translate this one document into all the languages of all the people so that they can all understand it. "In the name of the king Ahasuerus was it written and sealed with the king's ring. And the letters were sent by post into all the king's provinces." Do you think the post office was a new invention? You know, the Wild Wild West and what was the Pony Express? That wasn't the origin of the postal system. We've got it here in the book of Esther, in the land of Persia, all right, 2000 B.C., and they've got a postal system, all right. It's not an American invention from the Wild Wild West. All right, they had letters and they had a post. "And the letters were sent by post unto all the king's provinces. The mailmen delivered them to the 127 different provinces and posted them everywhere to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women." Now, who wrote this? Haman. Who is he? An Agagite. What did Agag do that was so reprehensible before God? He made women childless. He destroyed them and their unborn, their young children. That's what angered God. Now Haman's doing the same thing. Destroy all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women in one day. You are never going to make the Arab world like the rest of the world, because their mentality is completely different. It would take hundreds of years to change that, because they are taught from their infancy through the Quran to hate the Jew. They are taught in their, what we call Sunday school, from a very young age. When they go into their places of worship, they are taught from a very young age that the Jews are dogs, that they are heathen, that they're not at a human level. You know, Americans came out of the dark ages, so to speak, by realizing black men had souls just like white men. The Arabs have never come out of that area yet to recognize that the Jews are physically equal to any other people. In fact, they're God's chosen. If anything, they're a little bit higher. But they still do not treat them that way. And just walking over there and setting up these different things is not going to change it. They need to be saved. They need to come under the conviction of the Word of God, trust Christ as Savior. That's the only way you're going to straighten that thing out. You're not going to plant a democratic system over there and have that fix it. The reason it works here is because we are, or were, however you want to define it, a Christian nation, and it worked here. But it doesn't work in those other places. Here's Haman that wants to kill and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women. And can I tell you that if you do any reading about the Arab nations today, that's their desire right now, to kill all Jews, little women and little children. It doesn't matter to them. They're all the enemy. And a young child, especially a young boy, is just going to be a future adult Jew, and that's a threat to them. So it's a different mentality than you and I have. In one day, even upon the 13th day, I don't know why it's always 13th days going on here. I don't know if they were Fridays or not. This Friday is the 13th, by the way, if that matters to you. It doesn't matter to me. But, and the way the calendar's set up, March 13th is a Friday also. So I guess those are superstitious. You've got two rough days ahead of them. But here on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. Kill all the Jews, take what they got. That's the mentality of Haman back then. That's the mentality of the Arab today. Kill all the Jews, take what they've got, especially the land. From Dan to Beersheba, get the whole thing. The Golan Heights, the West Bank, we've got that so far, but let's get all of it. We want all that land. You know, there ain't nothing on that land that's worth anything. It's desert, dry land. Why? Because of Haman and the mentality they have. Verse 14. The copy of the writing for a commandment to be given in every province was published unto all people, that they should be ready against that day. And in other words, the mail carriers start going out on the 13th day of the first month. And they go into all 127 provinces or states or countries, however you want to think of it. They go into all the land that Ahasuerus is king over. And that's a large territory. So they begin on January 13th, so to speak, the first day, 13th day of the first month. And they begin handing out these flyers in the language of the people in the province they're in, that on the 13th day of the 12th month, it is a free-for-all. You can kill any Jew anywhere, anytime, any place, for any reason, and it's legitimate by government decree and government order, and you can repossess or take whatever they own on the 13th day of the 12th month. And they send this decree out through all of the 127 provinces under the hand of Ahasuerus. Verse 15. The post went out, being hastened by the king's commandment. In other words, there's a rush on this. It's overnight delivery. And the decree was given in Shushan the palace. All right, that's right where they're starting from. These people are going to know it before anybody else does. And notice, and the king and Haman sat down to drink. They've just signed a decree to destroy millions of people. And they sit down to drink. No conscience. No conviction. No worry. No guilt. They've just signed a decree and sealed it with a ring, sealing the doom, supposedly, of a whole lot of people. And to them, it's let's eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. They don't care. But notice the end of verse number 15. But the city Shushan was perplexed. Again, I like this old King James Bible because it uses words. I don't know what they changed that to. I know they're not going to use perplexed in the NIV. And I didn't look it up to see what it was. That's a great word. You know, when Herod heard about Jesus' miracles, the Bible says he thought it was John risen from the dead, and he was perplexed. So what does perplexed mean? You know, the best way to find the definition of a word is to look at every time it appears, and you can figure out the definition for yourself. I mean, the old 1828 dictionary is good if you've got a word that's only in the Bible like one time and you're trying to figure it out. You can look it up that way. But if you really want to know the meaning of a word, look at, and this word appears five times in the Bible, look at where it appears and it finds out. Herod was perplexed because he killed John the Baptist, and now this guy was doing miracles just like John, and he thinks it's John come back from the dead, and he's perplexed. All right, he's confused. But if it just meant confused, they'd have put confused. See, I have enough confidence in God and His preservation of our word that if you change the word, He would have used that word in the first place. You know, somebody says, well, in the Greek it means this. Well, then why didn't they translate it that way? They must have used perplexed on purpose. And Herod looked and he said, and it says he was perplexed because of that. You know what Paul said in 2 Corinthians 4:8? We are troubled on every side, yet not distressed. We are perplexed, yet not in despair. All right? We're troubled, we're perplexed, and there's some anxiety in it. The disciples, when they ran to the tomb in Luke chapter 24, and they went running to the tomb, and the stone was rolled back, and they walked into the tomb, and it was empty. You know what the Bible says? They were perplexed, confused, a little bit frightened. What in the world's going on here? Perplexed. The city of Shushan was perplexed. They didn't understand what was going on, and it was a little bit frightening. Here's a decree to destroy all of these people throughout all the 127 provinces, and they're wondering why. Why kill women and children, the innocent people? Why possess their lands and their houses and take all they own? Why are we doing this? They're a little bit worried, a little bit frightened, and they're perplexed. That's a great word. Paul said, we're perplexed, but not in despair. There's times that we think, what in the world's going on? And it's a little bit frightening. But don't worry about it. Because he said, we're perplexed, but not in despair. Next week in chapter 4, we'll find out what Mordecai does about this decree by Haman. Let's bow our heads in prayer.